This is All In. I'm Matt Pelser. Will machines replace us? What does it mean to belong? And are the divisions between us a matter of fact or perception? These are types of questions that Indiana Humanities has been posing to Hoosiers all across the state now for the past few years, but they aren't asking you to come up with the answers alone. Rather, they've been inviting strangers to gather together and share their thoughts, perspectives, and experiences with one another. What's the secret to getting strangers together for a thought-provoking, productive dialogue? Well, you may be amazed by what a good Vietnamese noodle soup can accomplish. Joining me now is Director of Programs and Community Engagement at Indiana Humanities, Leah Namias. Leah, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Leah, you just gave me the pronunciation. You've been one of the forces behind Chew on This, a series of dinners held across the state that foster conversation among communities. When you're inviting folks to these dinners, how do you describe what they can expect? What's the pitch?
This is a good question. So all good humanities programs are hard to describe at first, but over time we've kind of evolved the discussion, which is come together for a shared meal and a shared conversation with other curious Hoosiers. Facilitated by an expert facilitator or guided by, I like the word guided. So I think the keys there are we're going to share a meal. People kind of know what that looks like. They want to be around curious people and identify themselves as a curious Hoosier. And the idea that there's kind of someone there helping guide the conversation, I think is a little bit appealing too.
Where did the idea for Chew on This come from? Dinner and conversation sounds like a simple idea, but where did this originate?
Well, on some level, you're right. It's a simple idea. It's kind of doing something we already do as in our friend groups, right? And kind of expanding it into a more civic space with folks that we may not know and seeing what can happen with a conversation. So Indiana Humanities, we like to encourage Hoosiers to think, read, and talk. So talking, thinking, we don't do a lot of reading at this. You read the menu. That's about it. And so, but that's very for us. And we like to do that in kind of a smart, fun, and invitational way. A little over 10 years ago, we had a program called Food for Thought. So we were theming a lot of our programming around food. So I cannot claim credit for this great idea. My predecessor had this idea to, you know, use restaurants, use food as a way to bring people together to have conversations about food and our relationship to it and identity. We liked that program model so much that we just kept doing it even as our topics of our programming changed.
And the series is organized by Indiana Humanities, which is, it's the organization you work for. And what is that organization's mission? And how do these dinners align with that?
Great question. So we're a statewide nonprofit organization. And we like to say that we encourage people to think, read, and talk because the humanities themselves are one of those big, vague, scary words. But the humanities are how we think about our own identities and our relationships to each other and kind of what it means to be a human in the world, right? And so we like to find formats that are creative and fun and that kind of break down some of the barriers that folks might have, especially around the humanities, which sometimes kind of sound either elitist or like something you do in school or just something you're not quite sure what it is. But everybody knows how to come together and have a conversation over food. And so we kind of lean into that with a lot of our programming is creating spaces that kind of feel a little less formal and a little more open-ended. You know, this isn't a debate. This isn't like a sage on a stage, a guy with elbow patches, you know, standing on a stage. This is you. It's participatory. And I will also say that's a really key element to it as well is this is what happens in this space is people make meaning together. We don't say that the goal of this is to change your mind about anything, but it might be to expose you to a different point of view or to let you talk through an idea. I'm a verbal processor. I kind of think by talking. And I think that good programming can allow people to have that kind of space.
How do you decide what to talk about?
Great question. So we align our Chew on This topics to our thematic initiatives. So right now, in 2019 and 2020, our theme is called Inseparable, and it's really about how we relate to each other, especially across urban-rural lines. It feels like something that is a source of tension for a lot of folks, certainly a source of a lot of attention and conversation in the media. And we pick topics that we think just help open that conversation. So what divides us? Are we divided? And that question that you asked at the beginning, to what degree are our divides real or are they a matter of perception? And if it's perception, where does that perception come from? And then, you know, it kind of followed on that. We had our first one of those conversations last spring on the question of what divides us. And we asked people who participated, what do we need to talk about next? And the question of belonging and welcomingness, like how welcoming are our communities? And to people that either they're from across the county line or from another country or maybe a younger generation, right? All those questions are kind of tied up in belonging and welcomingness. So we kind of put our finger in the air, you know, you kind of lick it and wait for the wind to blow. Sometimes our topics, especially for Chew on This, are really kind of gut-based. It's like, this feels like something people want to talk about. If I myself am participating in a lot of these kind of conversations in my personal life, I kind of tend to think that might be a good conversation that others want to take part in too.
Yeah, these seem like really weighty topics though. And I'm thinking of all the busy people out there and the prospect of asking them to take time to sit down and ponder these heavy questions with strangers. Do you find that there is in fact a desire for these kinds of opportunities?
Yes. So I think the thing that we hear all the time, especially with Chew on This, is this is not like anything else that folks get to do. I think there's a sense of fun. We usually work with a restaurant, create a custom menu. You know, there's that part of it, which is like, ooh, I get to have this kind of special experience. It feels a little VIP. But that also, oh my gosh, I'm around other people who want to talk about this thing. That I think sometimes folks, especially, you know, I don't know, Midwesterners, Hoosiers, we have a lot of ideas about what it is and isn't polite to talk about. And sometimes we just need to create the invitation, like, hey, like, come on out. This is a permission structure to come out and talk about something. So the food helps. Food helps a lot, right? It kind of sets the table. I cannot avoid food metaphors.
Well, it's a shared experience.
Exactly.
Too.
It's a shared experience. And you don't have to do any homework, right? You can just kind of show up with your lived experience and your ideas. And what we find is that people tell us in the conversation and afterwards how much they value it. And then the other thing is that people who come once often come back. And that is always a sign that something's working. And they'll just say, I just love this. It feels smart, but it doesn't feel intimidating. It feels fun, but it feels like thought-provoking. So it collides a lot of like feelings that kind of give people a buzz.
With social media now, though, it's in some ways easier than ever to have a conversation with a stranger. As our mediums of communication have changed, how do you think that our conversations have as well, if at all? And I think that they certainly have.
Well, I might push back against the idea that we're having conversations on social media.
Good
I think
point.
We have broadsides on social media. And some people are really good joke tellers in that space. So I think nothing replaces people being in the room together and having, I mean, it holds you accountable, right? You can't, you see the person you're talking to, you're making eye contact.
You're not shouting into the void.
You're not shouting into the void. And hopefully you're not actually just shouting at the person across from you. There's something tempering about being part of a larger group as opposed to a back and forth. I think that is part of the thing that works. I think that that's actually one of the things people respond to with this programming is that we live such kind of digital and virtual lives. The effect of that is, yes, I have access to what people in California or New Mexico might be thinking about something, but I might be reading those thoughts rather than participating in a conversation face to face with people who live in my community. And I think that is part of what people respond to positively is the chance to kind of come together with others in their community.
Does it ever get spirited, for lack of a better term?
Like feisty.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think sometimes. I think one of the things I was talking about this with my colleagues, like what makes this program work? And people do kind of, there seems like there's a agreement that people come into the space with a sense of sincerity. People make like little jokes, but like there's like an earnestness to it that probably isn't very cool. Although, again, the restaurant helps make it feel more cool, I suppose, or like a good facilitator. You guys are going to meet Yesenia. She's very cool in a little bit. But yeah, I think that people disagree, but it's a civil sort of disagreement. Or I will say this the other thing. It's a disagree without necessarily like my job here is to change your mind. And I think that we don't have a lot of models of that in our public space right now. I think most of the time the conversations we see about big issues are like this side is right and this side is wrong, as opposed to like here's kind of my experience. Here's where I'm coming from. And I'm going to kind of listen in a good faith way and consider and not necessarily like walk away having the right answer, I suppose.
So then once you've decided what to talk about, how much consideration goes into where you'll host everything?
That's really important. The number one thing I think I've learned over time is do this in a private room so that your acoustics are good. Restaurants don't have great acoustics for conversation.
Yeah, and so you're not feeling stilted either.
Yeah, exactly. We kind of have to keep the group small enough that it can actually genuinely be a conversation. I hate having to say to people, nope, that table's full, but we kind of cap it between 12 and 13 folks so that everybody has a chance to participate. We keep an eye on price, so people do pay for their own tickets. So we try to work with a restaurant that'll give us a good meal and a good experience, but not pay through the nose for it.
Mm-hmm.
And that helps keep it more accessible. And then we really spend a lot of time thinking about a facilitator and what kind of questions do we want them to ask. And so we work a lot on finding folks that have some sort of expertise, maybe related to the topic, or prior experience facilitating conversation. We also look for people that might themselves be kind of a cool person that you'd want to come hang out with and talk to them and hear what they have to say. So those are the magic ingredients.
Make America Dinner Again is another meal and conversation initiative that started in California and then it went nationwide. And there have been similar groups all over the country doing this kind of ground level conversation work. Some of these groups aim to bridge divisions in the country. And I see how these programs can be a great conversation tool, but to bridge the political divisions in America seems like a tall order, even if the best lasagna is on the plate, as it were. Where do you see the role of these programs fitting into that conversation? We got about a minute left.
I think they help speak out. They push back against like the sense of the void, right? And I agree. I don't think that one conversation necessarily bridges all partisan divide. But I do think it's a start. It's a sense that like someone who disagrees with me is still a person that lives in the world and, has well-considered, thoughtful ideas, hopefully. And it's that bridge building is just kind of getting to know who's on the other side of something and opening up space for conversation. And, what we see is sometimes people are like, I want to keep doing this. And that feels it, it's like pushing the boulder to get it going, rolling.
Leah Namias, the Director of Programming and Community Engagement at Indiana Humanities. We really appreciate you joining us today to talk about this. She's going to stick around for the next segment as well. And up next, we will be joined by a past facilitator of a Chew on This dinner, as well as a professor who studies the relationship between community, food, and environment. As always, we'll take your questions and comments on social media. Do you think we should create more spaces for conversations among communities? Are chats over dinner enough to heal the divides among Americans today? Let us know. Get on Facebook and Twitter and find us at All In Indiana. I'm Matt Pelser. We're back in 90 seconds. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Matt Pelser. Before we get back to our conversation on Chew on This, I want to tell you about our last show. Yesterday, we talked about an unusual interrogation tool that's used by some police departments around the world, including in Elkhart, Indiana. Concerns have been raised around the tool's accuracy, and researchers have discouraged its use. You can find that show and all our shows wherever you get podcasts. Just search for All In. Today, we're talking about Chew on This and the power of food in cultivating community and conversation. As always, we would love your questions and comments on the topic. You can find us on Facebook and Twitter at All In Indiana. In the studio, we're back with Leah Namias, the Director of Programs and Community Engagement at Indiana Humanities. And we're also joined now by a former facilitator of a Chew on This discussion, Yesenia Tostado. Yesenia, thanks so much for being with us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
And via Skype, we're also joined by Professor Jennifer Robinson, an anthropologist at Indiana University who studies the intersections of food, self, and community. Professor Robinson, thanks for making the time.
Hi, nice to be here.
Yesenia, we'll start with you. Let's talk about your experience as a facilitator at one of these dinners. What was the topic that you led?
So the topic that I led was the who belongs here topic, and it was a really interesting conversation. The folks that attended the dinner were very open about sharing their experiences. They had diverse backgrounds. They represented a diverse age group and were just really engaged in the topic of creating spaces that are more welcoming and including more folks in their communities.
How'd you get the conversation started?
So I started the conversation by having folks go around the room and rating how welcoming their community is. And it was really interesting. Most of the folks that attended the dinner that I hosted were from Central Indiana, but different parts of Central Indiana, Zionsville, Southport, the Center Township part of Central Indiana, and the ratings that they gave, the welcoming sentiment of their community really was across the board. A lot of folks felt that it was basically somewhere between a 3 and a 7 was probably the most common response that I received.
Hmm. What does that mean, 3 and 7?
So 3 being not very welcoming, and then 7 getting more on the side of they felt that their community was more welcoming. But I would say that most folks were surprisingly kind of pessimistic about how welcoming they felt their community was.
What kind of restaurant was your dinner held at?
So the conversation that I facilitated was at Aksum Ethiopian Restaurant, which in itself was a really cool opportunity because Ethiopian food is communal. So folks had the opportunity to share dishes and learn about a new type of food that's also eaten with your hands and, has different spices than most folks are used to eating.
And so that is the role that the food played, was kind of being able to pass it around. And
absolutely. In some ways, it's kind of an icebreaker. It allows people to have a shared new experience, which really level sets the opportunity for this engaging discussion.
Professor Robinson, we spoke last segment about the power of bringing folks together over food. And we know everybody's got to eat, but can you help explain the unifying power that food seems to hold?
Sure. Yeah, we all do have to eat. And food really reflects the ways that we are human, the ways that we're together in physical and social ways. People like to eat every day. They like to eat on a predictable basis. The food sustains us. But for modern people, most of the time, we get our food from other people. We rely on food as a cooperative endeavor. People grow it. They process it, ship it, and distribute it, and then we bring it home. And even in the home, we often rely on other people's labor. There's somebody else perhaps cooking for us all the time or some of the time. The cooking that we eat is based on recipes that are passed down over time or are somehow there are these interesting anonymous phenomena. You know, how do you make the cookie? It has been passed down through the family. So food is a little bit inherited. It's a little bit created on the spot. It has a lot of creativity. And it's a way that we, the previous speaker said really nicely that we share experiences together through food. And even when our experience is different, that itself is a subject of discussion potentially. So food's amazingly flexible in connecting us and carrying all kinds of meaning and stories that we want to tell about ourselves, traditions, choices, politics, social groupings, and standing. It is something that we can be amazed by and inspired by as well as physically sustained by.
Leah, we know that one of the goals of Chew on This is to bring together a diversity of voices, but to bring together a diverse group of people isn't always as simple as it sounds. What are some of the challenges of getting a variety of perspectives at the table?
So people self-select for this conversation, right? So people come because they want to have a conversation about belonging and how welcoming their community is. And that may just not be for everybody. And it, you know, you might conjecture that the people who are most responsible for an unwelcoming community are least likely to take place in a conversation about welcomingness. So that is definitely one of the biggest challenges. We work really hard to keep the price point affordable. And we have some programs, most of our programs are usually free. We usually, you know, if we have grant funding, we'll do waivers for costs. But this one program is one that has a price. And so that can be a barrier. And that comes up a lot. I kind of like it when the group kind of critiques the form of the program. It tells me they're really thinking. I'm a former teacher, so I'm like, yes, if you are critiquing the teacher, you're doing the good, hard intellectual work. And so sometimes people will say, well, I just feel like other people aren't in this room. Now, I will say this is an Indianapolis-centric joke, but we'll have a conversation in Meridian Kessler on the north side of Indianapolis, and people will say, well, everyone here is kind of like white and middle class. And it's like, yeah, maybe you should have signed up for a conversation that wasn't in Meridian Kessler. That's the first sign of learning, right? So, but I think that opens up a conversation, which is like, who's not in the room? Whose voices, how would this conversation be different if other people were in the room? And that kind of thinking is a good start too. I also think it's really important that when we choose facilitators, we choose people that have diverse life experiences, socioeconomic, racial backgrounds, because I think that that is part of how we communicate that lots of different kinds of people are welcome.
And have you organized dinners in rural communities?
Yeah. So that's one of the things I'm most excited about in 2019 is we took this program, which we used to do mostly in cities, and that was a practical choice about where's a place where we think we could get like 15 people together. And we've expanded. So we've done it in Batesville. We've done it in Middlebury. We've done it in Rensselaer and some other smaller communities. And we actually created an application where folks could say, we want to bring this program to our community. And that has been awesome. I think say a lot of the recruitment in smaller communities happens on a one-to-one basis. It is people saying, hey, I'm organizing this event. I really want you to be here. And that is kind of the magic that kind of happens in smaller communities that isn't always possible in an urban community. I actually sometimes think about so much of our work to get people to talk together is kind of predicated on an urban sense of people don't know each other, whereas I grew up in a small town. And if you're from a small town, it's like, oh, I know somebody. I just don't want to talk to that person. So that invitation really, really matters too. And I think that that kind of dynamic, rich conversation has been really good in rural communities as well.
Just curious. Batesville's really close to where I grew up. Where'd you go in Batesville? Do you remember the restaurant?
Oh, I think we were at the Sherman, but I can't remember for sure. I'm from down
that sounds
part
about right.
of the world, too.
Are
so.
You really? Okay, we'll have to talk about that after the show. We're here with Leah Namias, the Director of Programs and Community Engagement at Indiana Humanities. We're also with Yesenia Tostado, who's facilitated a chew on this talk, and Professor Jennifer Robinson, an anthropologist at IU who studies the intersections of food, self, and community. Professor Robinson, agriculture plays a big role in Indiana, of course. Do we see examples of food bringing rural and urban communities together organically?
We do. You know, I was just reflecting on the persimmon pudding as really a signature food of Indiana. And I've heard from people who've moved to other places around the country that one of the things they really miss about Indiana is being able to even get persimmons to then make the pudding. When they come back here, they seek that out. So that's kind of a connection to not just agriculture, but really to the wild environment, to the native plants that are here. But one of the places that we really see rural and urban intersections on a regular basis is at farmers markets. And there are many markets around the state, and there are, I just heard recently, there are over 200 community gardens and urban farms in Indianapolis itself. So there are places where the urban and rural meet. In Bloomington, we've had an interesting controversy this season where some vendors have been accused of being white supremacists, of having ties to white supremacy. And so that's been a very interesting and passionate and divisive event where the rural and urban communities are trying to sort out how we relate to each other and to what extent we rely on each other. The small farmers who go to markets are really banking literally on being able to make a certain number of sales to earn a certain amount of money in those economic centers. And then at the same time, many residents of urban communities would like to have that taste of fresh agriculture. They don't really want to import their sweet corn from 1,000 miles away or their melons from 1,000 miles away. They would like to get them right here from people they can talk to. They can tell them what their values are. They can ask them about their growing practices and so on. So I think farmers markets are a way to plug in very simply to that gathering of communities. And what we're finding in Bloomington is that there are really important conversations to have across those communities, as some of these other programs are describing as well, is how do we get together to talk with people we may not we may not otherwise meet, we may not otherwise have substantive conversations with. And food somehow leavens and enables and facilitates those conversations in really positive ways.
Well, and along those lines, and this is an interesting point, for as much as food can unite us, are there ever times where it actually serves to further the divide in some way?
Yeah, I mean, there are, and it's been, we've seen some of that in Bloomington this year, but I think that this is quite typical of food. Food is unites us, but it unites us relative to who, you know, or to whom, to say more correctly. You know, it shows us who we are relative to other people, who we are not. So, for example, lobster used to be considered a poor person's food. You would know you weren't poor because you were not eating lobster. It was consumed by prisoners and slaves and people who did not have very many means. But now it's associated with affluence and privilege. And, you know, the food itself hasn't changed, but the way that we think about it and the way that it divides us has changed. Same with bread. If you look at historically, brown bread was the bread that poorer people ate, and white bread, more refined bread, was for rich people. But then that sort of reversed, you know, so that whole bread, you know, brown bread was seen as whole grain and it was recognized as more nutritious, so more affluent people now eat it. And artisan breads, the white light sourdoughs that are so beautiful and are made in small batches, that there's a white bread that has risen again, I guess, to become a bread that's desirable to more affluent people. So these things can be again, the foods themselves don't necessarily carry that meaning, but people imbue foods with meaning. And it can be done very purposefully through political boycotts and political stances. Like, you'll remember Freedom Fries when the U.S. was in conflict with France over the Iraq War, and people renamed French fries to Freedom Fries. You know, so that can be used very definitely to divide people.
Yesenia, as we have these conversations in our communities, what are keys to being a good facilitator?
So I think being an active listener and setting ground rules for participants, just to let them know or to set the expectation that all thoughts and ideas should be respected. I think encouraging folks around the table to share as they feel comfortable is really important, just to make sure that everyone's voice is being heard and that the conversation isn't being dominated just by one or two people in the room.
Leah, in speaking with facilitators, in being present at a lot of these conversations yourself, what have been some of the highlights from these conversations?
So I think one of the moments I kind of described earlier, when people start to go, well, who's not in the room and how would this conversation be different? That's a sign to me that people are really listening and kind of expanding their minds. I think when people can talk about serious stuff, when people bring personal experience and identity, things that, you know, to talk about those with a stranger is a risk. When people feel comfortable to share that or to share doubt, I think that's another thing that in our public culture, we're not very good at just saying, I'm not sure, or I just don't know. Those are always signs of success to me. Some of the conversations that have been really cool, like I know the group up in Rensselaer, they had such a good conversation, and it turned, this was about the what divides us. And I think it opened up a lot of conversations about generational change in leadership in the community. And who, you know, if you weren't born there, were you really welcome to make a difference in that community? Which I see you're nodding your head. Mm. And so they said, and there was this partnership with the Community Foundation, they were like, we want to keep having these conversations. This feels really important. So those are some things in the recent past that have really stuck out to me as memorable, like signs of success, and then some particularly memorable conversations. And I heard that both Yesenia's and we had another a couple of conversations in Indianapolis in the last round were all really good. So we must have had a really good crop of facilitators. Thank you, Yesenia.
You prepare material and tips for facilitators before they begin to guide these conversations. And there are a lot of people who are about to be having conversations over food during the holidays. Can you walk us through how to facilitate a conversation, that maybe a crash course, a 101?
Okay, so Ask open-ended questions. Don't ask yes-no questions. Don't ask do you agree or not. As much as possible, try to get people to kind of break away from like defending a point of view. That may not be where you want to start. Humans do that naturally. We want to talk about our values and beliefs. Like there's a method called shared inquiry, which would say you need to do some interpretive work first, which is like, well, what does that mean? Or why would someone say that? And then have an opinion about it. So try to slow that conversation down a little bit. I would say, and you know, this is a very humanities answer, engage around a shared text, like watch a TV show together and use that as a jumping off point for a conversation about an idea that's raised, like, and use interpretive questions. Well, what did you think when that character did this? Or why do you think that character did this? Then use that to kind of as a springboard for a larger conversation. Even the act of watching a TV show together can be a shared experience that you can then interrogate in an open-ended way.
Got about a minute left. For those of us who are interested in participating, Leah, in future Chew on This conversations, where should we keep our eyes open?
So please visit IndianaHumanities.org. We are in the early stages of planning our next one, which will probably take place in April, and probably looking at the question of local journalism and why it matters, because a lot of people think that divides are related to journalism and how we consume media. But we'll be announcing details about that after the first of the year. And you can sign up for our newsletter and stay tuned.
Leah Nami is Director of Programs and Community Engagement at Indiana Humanities. Thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you.
Yesenia Tostado, a former facilitator of Chew on This. Thank you.
Thank you.
And Professor Jennifer Robinson, an anthropologist from IU. We really appreciate you sharing your expertise today.
Thanks.
Up next, we'll close out the show with a recent conversation I had with Pat Cook, the chief elf of Santa Claus, Indiana. You can imagine a chief elf is pretty busy this time of year. We'll catch up with Pat about how she and her team of elves are able to answer the thousands of letters that roll in the Christmas-themed town every year. I'm Matt Pelser. We're back in 90 seconds. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Matt Pelser. Every year at Christmas time, children from around the world write thousands of letters to Santa Claus. Santa Claus, Indiana, that is. That's right. If you're from the southwestern part of the state, you may be familiar with America's Christmas hometown, which is also home to the Holiday World theme park. Joining us now to talk about the magic that makes answering all of those letters possible is Chief Elf of Santa Claus, Indiana, Pat Cook. Mrs. Cook, we're so happy to have you today.
Thank you. Good morning to everybody. Merry Christmas. And yes, we have thousands of letters. We've probably done 20,000 so far, and we are going down the finish line.
Yes, this has got to be a busy, busy time of year for Santa Claus, Indiana. And we know that you and your team of elves are busy answering letters from children all over the world. About how many do you get every year?
It depends upon how much publicity we get normally, but it's always between 20 and 25,000.
Wow. Thousands, tens of thousands.
I think we're online to probably set a record this year, it looks like.
And what will that record look like? Will that be closer to 30?
It would be over 25,000. Yeah.
Goodness. And you respond to every single one?
We do as well as we possibly can. We try very, very hard. Because you understand that some children get their letters out, I suppose, without their parents seeing it. So we don't always have a very good address. We can look up part of it now in this wonderful world of technology, and we try to do that. Right now I have a letter on the table that we called a mother. We did have a phone number. We're trying to get in touch with her to get an address. Because we really want to, we want these children to get a reply. And we try our hardest. But if there is no way that we have an address, you know what I say, Santa knows where you are, but we don't.
What kinds of things do you say in the replies? Are they specific to what they say in their letters?
We try to do that, yes. And we really work at that. Like, you know, if they're trying to be potty trained, we wish them well with that. Or if they're sucking their thumb, and I had a young girl say the other day, she hasn't been naughty or nice. She's just been mediocre. So we help, you know, tell her to keep trying to be better. We always try to be uplifting and encouraging. We don't refer to their requests for a gift, because we're not sure what Santa's going to bring. So we have to be very careful with that. You know, we also don't tell them they're doing something wrong. We try to encourage them and help them to feel better about their art and their schoolwork and being good. So we try. We have some, you know, basic things like Mrs. Claus is helping me get ready. The elves are getting really excited. The elves are working hard, which are all true, you know.
Well, and what kinds of things are they writing about in these letters? Obviously, what they want and things like that. But what are some surprises that you've come across over the years?
We probably have. It's absolutely wonderful because they open their hearts to us in these letters. And I think that's wonderful. Many of them do ask for many things. And we do have a letter that says sometimes Santa can't give you everything you want. But, you know, many of them are proud of what they've accomplished, and we share that. Many of them are living in a situation that they're not happy in, and they tell Santa about that. Many of them are trying to be good and maybe are just kind of good. So they tell us all sorts of things. One little boy said, "What do you do when you have to go, Santa?" Yeah. So they're always... they'll say, you know, please bring some. I just read one that said, bring my granddaddy a leaf blower. How nice that you're thinking of your granddaddy. Or my mom really wants a wallet. You know, that they're thinking of others. Some kids say, please bring gifts to kids who don't have as much as I do. And then we really applaud that because they're thinking of others. So we got a front door key one time, because they didn't have a chimney. So we get almost anything you can imagine.
And how is it that all these letters find their way to Santa Claus, Indiana? I guess there's a Santa Claus, Arizona, a Santa Claus, Georgia. How'd we get so lucky?
There are no other Santa Claus post offices in the United States. We are the only one. There are like a North Pole, Alaska, and a Christmas, Georgia, and a few other imitators, but we are the only Santa Claus post office, and that was made by the post office department, that we would be the only Santa Claus post office. So they come to us in many, many ways. They come from schools in great big manila envelopes. They come individually. They come here to our original post office building and write letters. Parents stop by and drop off letters, but the miracle of it all is they come, and they come sometimes without a lot of information, and yet we try very hard to get an answer out to them.
And how long has this been going on? How long has the flood of letters to Santa Claus, Indiana been going on, and how long then have we been responding to these letters?
Well, we've been told, and of course we have no documentation for this, the post office was established in 1856 as a post office in Santa Claus. And we have that document in our museum. And I think the wonder of it all is that the postmaster who asked that this place get a post office, his name was Nikolaus, which is just magical, you know. Nikolaus Fisher asked to have this town and signed the document. So they say it's been going on for 100 years. I'm only 88 years old, so I'm not sure about that. But anyway, I know it's been going on as long as we've had a post office. And then I also know that it became more more organized when my father returned from the Navy in World War I in the 1930s. And decided to help the postmaster, who, of course, post office is severely overworked at this time of year. So my dad said, you know, I need to help the post office. And he got a little more organized with taking the letters out to the Legion Post and the VFW and the monasteries and the typing classes and wherever he could to get these letters answered. And so I've been part of that for a very, very long time.
And his name was Jim. He came to be known as Santa Jim. Yes. What did the role of Santa mean to your dad?
Oh, my goodness. He was a absolute believer, an absolute advocate of the wonderful wonderful world that Santa brings to people. You know, the world of peace and love and joy and happiness and giving and caring. My thing is, why aren't we always like we are at Christmas time? Because we're an awful lot nicer and care more about people. But he was very seriously a very loving person and loved children and wanted that belief to be kept all of his life. And of course it was. So, you know, he was, Santa Claus has to have a few helpers, but Santa Claus is real.
And what was it like for you then to grow up as essentially the daughter of Santa Claus?
Strangely enough, it was very normal for me because it was just part of my life. I always believed and still do. And, you know, we had bells and boots and suits at our house, and that was okay. Santa Claus came, and that was all right. You know, there were times when I was a little older, probably preteen, that I was a little embarrassed, but I really, everybody knows how much I admired my dad and how much I thought he was such a wonderful person to keep this wonderful story alive and this belief alive in a world where people don't all believe in what's right and what's good.
And of course, yours is the family who got Santa Claus Land, now known as Holiday World and Splash and Safari, opened up in, when was it, 1946?
Correct. My father-in-law. Yes.
Yeah. So that was his idea to open up the park?
Yes. He came here. He had retired from his business in Evansville, had had a heart attack and turned it over to his sons. He was driving around and saw this town called Santa Claus. He had 9 children. And he said, what a shame that there isn't a park here. Something, what if people come here to visit? There's nothing here. So he started the very, very small park called Santa Claus Land, which consisted of a large Bavarian building that had a souvenir shop, a dining room, and Santa Claus in the toy shop. And then some old time cars and reindeer. And it was just a very small undertaking. I'm sure he had no idea what it would become. And then, of course, my husband came out of World War II and asked him if he could take it over. And he did. And that's all history and how it has developed and changed into Holiday World in 84. So really, you know, 40 some years until the change.
And was this an idea when it came about that the town was excited about, or was there any hesitancy?
Well, I don't know. It was 46. I was in high school, and people were happy about it because it gave people work. There were people working in the dining room and in the souvenir shop and taking care of the deer. And it was a place to eat because the dining room was wonderful. So I think most of the people were excited about it. And there were farmers living in the area that their wives got work or their children. So mostly they were excited about it. Yes. And supportive.
And now Holiday World has grown far beyond just celebrating Christmas, but it must be a special time of the year there, and you continue to keep this tradition alive of answering all these letters to Santa. How many elves does it take to help answer all of these letters, these 25,000 some a year?
A whole bunch. Many, many, many. And especially this year, we've had years when we really caught up and got caught up with letters. This year, they just keep coming in, and maybe it's because of we have gotten a lot more publicity, and that always brings on more letters. But we're glad to help children believe, and when they get a letter from Santa, I think it makes them very happy. I think it makes the parents happy. What we're sad about, you know, is if there is no good address, or if a letter gets lost in the mail and we don't get it, and then we get blamed. But that's rare. But, you know, 25,000 letters are a lot of letters to keep track of. So we have wonderful volunteers, people that, you know, at this time of the year could be doing many other things, come in and help every single day, and that's absolutely wonderful. I think they say they get hooked once they come, because reading the letters and seeing how much it means to the children is wonderful, and the good things that happen because of us answering. So, people say, how many do you have? I don't count people. I'm glad they come. And we get groups, and we get young people's groups, like Young Optimists and foreign exchange students. And so we stay in the evening for groups, like people that work all day want to come after work, because we want to get the letters answered for Santa. He's really busy right now, getting his sleigh ready.
Indeed. And I've heard that you even make sure that if a letter arrives in a different language, that the team will make sure that it gets answered in that language. How do you make that happen?
Well, we try that. But, we do have foreign exchange students. They'll be coming tonight, I think. And we have students from Germany, Spain, Netherlands, all over the world. And they do help us with that. I can do German. My daughter can do Spanish. Really and truly, most of the foreign countries write in great English, and they're very proud of that. They have learned English in school. They write beautifully, and they write beautiful grammar. So mostly we can write in English to them. They're proud that they can speak English and write English. It's very important to them, as it should be to us.
And what do you want kids around the world to know about Santa Claus, either the man or the town?
Well, Santa Claus is real. And we get letters from children, of course, saying, my friends say you're not real, or my mom says you're not real. And we always say, Santa is real. And Santa will live forever. And Santa is what's all good in the world, like bringing love and joy and bringing families together. So believing in Santa is very important, I think, to all of us and to our culture.
Do kids still have time to write to Santa this year?
Oh, yes. We've answered over 20,000 already. So many, many, many of them believe very strongly. And we're glad of that. We're glad for that.
And are you and the team of elves going to be working down to the wire? When is quitting time? Is it Christmas Eve?
We must have our letters here by the 20th, which is next Friday, because it is the weekend. The post office only works a half a day on Saturday. They do not work on Sunday. And if we would send a letter out on the 23rd, it would probably not arrive at its destination. And we don't think that a letter after Christmas is appropriate. So that's why we are working feverishly to get these letters out in the next few days. And I hope everybody understands that, because we're trying really hard to help Santa get all these schools back, letters back to the schools, because they'll be closing. And we want them to get their letters, but we have to get them in, now.
And if kids want to write in, how should they make sure to address their letter, or how should they make sure to format it in some way so that you can get the letter back to them?
Well, we get it no matter what they say on the envelope, mostly. But there are some we don't get, I know, and some we get that, as I said, we can't answer. But it's P.O. Box 1, Santa Claus, Indiana, 47579.
All right. Pat Cook, Chief Elf of Santa Claus, Indiana. Can you repeat that address one more time?
Santa Claus, P.O. Box 1, Santa Claus, Indiana, 47579. But as I said, I probably should go out today so we can answer it by Friday or Saturday.
All right. Pat Cook, thank you so much. We're so glad you could join us today. Have a great holiday. Merry Christmas.
Merry Christmas to you. Thank you.
Our producers are Drew Dodlin and Maggie Galon. Scott Cameron's our managing editor. Our show is engineered by Adam Gross and Chris Flood. If you'd like a podcast of this show or any past show, you can get it wherever you get podcasts. Be sure to subscribe so you always know what we're talking about. Join us tomorrow when we'll talk about esophageal cancer, and you'll recognize the voice of one of our guests if you're listening in East Central Indiana, Morning Edition's Stan Sollers, who was recently declared cured of the disease. Find us on Twitter and Facebook at All In Indiana. We're back tomorrow at this time for that conversation. I'm Matt Pelser. Thanks for listening. This is All In.